Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. I'll introduce our speakers very briefly. We'll start right on half past. I ask you to turn off your phones, as I'm about to do. So today we're discussing the topic, the world financial crisis, how did it happen? And our speakers will each speak for about 15 minutes each. So that'll take us up to about 6:15, and then we'll have time for questions and discussion. We'll finish before 7, probably at about 6:45 or thereabouts. We'll start off with Mark Johnson. Mark is the former Deputy Chairman of Macquarie Bank and a member of the APEC Business Advisory Council. His term on that council was renewed by the Rudd government. And then we'll go to Dr. Timo Henkel, who's a Research Fellow, Centre for Applied Macroeconomic Analysis at the Australian National University in Canberra. And then we'll go to Dr. John Edwards, who of course has spoken at the Sydney Institute on a couple of times before, the chief economist at the HSBC Bank. So many thanks to our three speakers today, and it's a great topic to effectively start the year. So we start off with Mark Johnson, the world financial crisis, how did it happen? Mark, thank you.
Thank you, Jared, and good afternoon or good evening, ladies and gentlemen. If it wasn't so overused, one would, of course, resort to Joe Enlai and his remarks on the French Revolution. It's too early to tell, and it really is too early to tell. But nevertheless, you've got to have a construct of the world, and so you've got to do the best with what we've got at the moment. So, how did it happen? The man at the centre of the crisis, who's the Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke, described the evolution of the crisis in a speech to the London School of Economics, Timo's old school, earlier this month in a very major speech. He said, the proximate cause was the turn of the housing cycle in the United States and the associated rise in delinquencies on subprime mortgages, which imposed substantial losses on many financial institutions and shook investor confidence in credit markets. He went on, however, although the subprime debacle triggered the crisis, the developments in the US mortgage market were only one aspect of a much larger and more encompassing credit boom whose impact transcended the mortgage market to affect many other forms of credit. Aspects of this broader credit boom, he said, included widespread declines in underwriting standards, breakdowns in lending oversight by investors and ratings agencies, increased reliance on complex and opaque credit instruments that proved fragile under stress, and unusually low compensation for risk-taking. I think in his last comment he was talking about risk return on assets rather than investment bankers' salaries. The case I want to make to you is that the credit boom, to which Chairman Bernanke refers, was fueled by imbalances that grew out of the Asian financial crisis in 1997 and 98. But behind that credit boom, some of the roots of this crisis can be traced to policy decisions or non-decisions over many years, most of which look very sensible in their context. It can also be traced to structural features in a number of important economies, some of which actually go back to the Depression years of the 30s, and to an intellectual climate that grew to equate financial markets with limited or little regulation with both efficiency and stability. So, the big picture I'm going to try and give you. The crisis is still in progress, and it's going to be many years before there's a consensus on what actually brought it about. I want to give you my perspective on five large elements, which I believe were amongst those that contributed to or fostered the credit boom. The first is liquidity, the wall of money, the loose or accommodative monetary policies which brought this credit boom into being, particularly amongst Western financial institutions and consumers over the last 10 years or so. The second is global imbalances, the recycled reserves of China and other exporting nations which financed this wall of money. The third piece I want to look at is what this global liquidity led to, a world of low interest rates, low cost of capital, and, not surprisingly, rising asset values. The fourth element is the intellectual and regulatory environment in which all this took place, particularly in the US and the United Kingdom. The fifth piece covers the growth of the shadow banking system and the explosive growth in the last several years of the substantially unregulated capital markets. There will be many different perspectives, and I'm sure John and Timo will put emphasis on other matters. But I think these five ingredients were certainly material in creating the broader credit boom that Chairman Bernanke identified. Liquidity is first. Monetary policy, nicely described as accommodative, was used by the United States authorities to deal with the 97-98 financial crisis, the threats perceived in Y2K, remember Y2K? The 9/11 terrorist attack and the bursting of the dot-com boom. Earlier market difficulties, such as the savings and loan bust in the United States and the long-term credit markets failure, were dealt with in similar fashion. Many of you will be aware of the Greenspan put. It was probably a flippant observation when it was first made, but over the past decade, the markets have come to look for an asymmetric response from the authorities when difficulties were anticipated. Official intervention and more liquidity could be anticipated to deal with events that threatened a downturn in the economy. Others see the credit expansion as being much longer, encompassing the 60-year history of the use of the US dollar and as an international reserve currency. This is still a contentious issue. Some traditional measures don't necessarily support this long-tail view. But what is really clear is that from the 1990s, in the United States and in Europe, financial assets expanded much more than the GDPs in the relevant countries. This growth in financial assets particularly took the form of derivative securities, initially related to interest rates, later to credit default swaps, and then to securitized loans of many types. Proponents of this analysis of new money see this vast pyramid of securitized debt and derivatives standing on top of the money supply directly affected by central banks. By their nature, these derivatives offer opportunities for leverage, and they attract leverage as asset markets rise in response to lower interest rates. At the same time as all this credit was being expanded, the US was running an increasing current account deficit, the Walmart syndrome. The US was driving the growth of China by purchasing more and more of China's cheaper manufactured exports. A big picture view is that maybe 2 billion new workers entered the globalized economy over the last decade or so. This increase in the supply of cheaper labor lowered the cost of many manufactured goods and increased return to capital, raising the price of corporate equities that were not directly exposed to import competition. So that brings us to the second big piece. How did America go on buying more than it sold or more than it earned for a decade? The answer is fairly straightforward. China and Japan and Germany and many other emerging economies financed the US by putting the US dollars they earned into U.S. securities, particularly U.S. government treasury securities and other government securities. So American treasure, U.S. dollars, went overseas to buy all those good things from emerging markets in China and others, and they sent that treasure back. China sent back more than $1 trillion over the last decade. I find it hard to visualize trillions, so many zeros, but it's a lot of money. Part of this story is the lessons that the Asian countries drew from their experiences in the 97-98 financial crisis. They've got export-oriented development models that require suppressed exchange rates, and these factors, plus other domestic policies, led to the theory of a global savings glut. The users of savings in the United States were being financed by these surplus savers in other parts of the world. All of these factors are very important, and I believe the 97-98 crisis contains many of the precursors of this crisis. But for present purposes, what we need to understand is that China and others recycled their rapidly growing reserves, particularly into high-quality U.S. securities, U.S. Treasury and U.S. government agency bonds, so the U.S. was able to finance its deficit very easily at low rates. So what kind of outcome do you get when you've got a bunch of people, particularly in the United States, spending a lot of money, and that money coming essentially from these savers, putting it in at low interest rates? Well, that was increasingly visible in the early years of this decade, particularly in the US and in Anglo-Saxon countries. We saw low interest rates, low cost of capital, created conditions for increasing asset values, particularly for corporate securities and for financial assets. Credit became cheaper, more available, cheap imports kept the inflation figures down. The U.S. consumer was so affected by these conditions that personal savings, which were already low, around 2 or 3% of GDP, actually went negative. And U.S. consumers drew on their credit cards or used the equity in their houses to buy more and to speculate in other houses, because that looked like a very good speculation. Mortgage rates were cheap, mortgages were readily available, and housing prices were going up. So we got a mixture of liquidity in Western markets being financed cheaply, particularly by China. We've got derivatives and other securities adding to easily available credit. We've got asset prices rising, and we've got cheap and easily available debt if you wanted to increase your returns. Remember what it was like? These were the Goldilocks years, when everything was just right. It was the product of policies that appeared to have conquered cycles, conquered inflation, conquered instability. Income distribution might have been a little more skewed, and rising housing prices were an impediment to first home buyers, but Goldilocks gave above average growth rates to economies all around the world. The great Walter Badgett observed, preceding the insights of Kahneman and all the behavioral economists, that all people are most credulous when they are most happy. All people includes bankers, dealers, investors, and also accountants, supervisors, ratings agencies, and regulators. So while all this stew was brewing, what were the regulators doing? What was the regulatory environment? In the United States, it was outmoded, often confused, and extremely politicized. The Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, dates back to 1934, and by the 1990s, it was not a vigorous institution. Separate federal and state banking regulation continues to this day, and the commodities and futures markets, intimately associated with financial markets, also dating from the 1930s, are still regulated apart from financial markets. Some institutions with great weight in the markets, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, were highly politicized by the people who ran them and by the politicians who could gain benefit from them. In 2005, Alan Greenspan told a Senate committee that the enormous portfolios of these companies, they held paper representing nearly one quarter of the US mortgage market, posed significant risks to the nation's financial system should either company face significant problems. I think the other big regulatory issue was the issue incorporated in Glass-Steagall. In 1929, it was seen that underwriting securities and distributing securities was part in common with commercial banking, that is, conducting it under one roof was part of the cause of the 1929 crash. And so in the Glass-Steagall Act in 1933, prohibited U.S. institutions from being both investment banks and commercial banks in our parlance. In 1999, a long lobbying campaign resulted in Glass-Steagall being repealed, and so the U.S. commercial banks were given the freedom to underwrite a full range of equity and debt securities. This was all in tune with the times. The tendency towards deregulation had grown from the 1970s. It was given further intellectual stimulus by the doctrine of efficient markets, which evolved from academia but applied right through the real financial markets. It found a philosophical and political welcome in the Thatcher and Reagan years, and anyway, the Goldilocks years proved that it was working. All of this came to support the view that less regulation in financial markets was likely to confer greater benefits on consumers. Deregulation, after all, had showed a lot of benefits in financial innovation and in increased competition. New products, new institutions proliferated, costs to consumers were reduced across a spectrum of financial services. Just think of the mortgage market in Australia, when you had to rely on the banks, of what you can get now. Competition and variety improved conditions for consumers. A couple of anecdotes just to illustrate the climate of the times. In 1996, Alan Greenspan warned of irrational exuberance in the markets when the Dow went through 6,000 on the way up. But he took no action on that in accordance with the central banker's doctrine of not pricking bubbles, but only being there to clean up afterwards. In 1998, there were moves by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission to bring the massive increase in over-the-counter derivatives under greater regulation. Mr. Greenspan and others opposed this on the grounds that it was unnecessary anyway, because the self-interest of sophisticated market participants could be relied upon to maintain stability. So, cheap debt, low risk premiums, plenty of money being lent, not being restrained particularly by legislators, abolition of grants Glass-Steagall meant that the separate models of investment banks and commercial banks were merged and blurred, and almost certainly so in the minds of regulators. What we got was what's been described as the shadow banking system and an explosive growth in capital markets as everybody got into everybody else's business. The commercial banks set up off-balance sheet vehicles so that they didn't have to apply as much capital to their activities. The investment banks started to extend credit to hedge funds and to acquirers, and there was an explosive growth in activity. The investment banks particularly increased their leverage, and so you'll probably remember that when Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers went down, the apparent balance sheet leverage was maybe in the range of 40 to 1 or 50 to 1, and probably that understated the actual degree of risk. Governor Glenn Stevens described this in a speech in October 2008. He said, "It suffices to say that a lot of new risk was created, and far from being widely dispersed, a good deal of it ended up on the balance sheets of the most leveraged parts of the international financial system, banks and investment banks." This shadow banking system essentially grew outside the control of the banking regulators, and you will be aware of the growth of the so-called toxic assets, collateralized debt obligations, which are derivative securities. Just a couple of anecdotes to give you some feel for size. I don't know how many companies are listed on the New York Stock Exchange, several thousand. But by 2007, there were 37,000 structured finance issues in the US alone, which were rated AAA. These securities had been manufactured on the assumption that the underlying securities created that AAA risk, which implies, of course, virtually no risk of default. As Chairman Bernanke observed, in the middle of 2008, these flaws all became apparent. For example, of the 30 tranches of AAA asset-backed CDOs underwritten by Merrill Lynch in 2007, by the end of the year, 27 were subsequently downrated to junk. So, as the bubble started to deflate, and the Merrill incident, the Merrill anecdote demonstrates, it became obvious that a lot of securities had been created that were actually genuinely toxic. They were impossible to value. Any institution that held these securities on their balance sheet had an asset that was not just of dubious value, but an asset whose value was so opaque that there was actually no market. And when that happens, when institutions are holding assets on their balance sheet that nobody can value, other institutions don't lend them money, and they become insolvent very quickly. This is the fear that emerged in June and July 2007, ran through Northern Rock, Bear Stearns, Lehman, Merrill Lynch, Bank of America, Citigroup, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and so on. And it's the crisis in confidence that is still going on today. So, what are the origins of this crisis? As has been observed, risk had not been distributed to the degree that it had been assumed. Banks were not as well capitalized as it seemed, and the liquidity risk, the risk of banks being able to borrow from one another, had been grossly underestimated. There were failures in incentives, in regulation, and in supervision, so that the world had underestimated the risks that developed in financial markets in the 1990s and on into the new century. The ease with which this credit boom had been financed obviously contributed to that miscalculation. I want to conclude just by posing a couple of the fundamental questions that arise out of this. The question remains whether these risks are inherent in a substantially unregulated, whether they're inherent in substantially unregulated markets. Was the current crisis caused by too much government intervention or by too little? This argument, traditional investment banks who've never been subject to commercial bank regulation became lenders like banks, and the commercial banks who were subject to traditional commercial bank regulation became traders in securities like the investment banks. This was in this context that I've specified that it had been a developing belief in the last 20 or 30 years that this tension between stability and efficiency had been satisfactorily resolved in the capital markets, where regulation was light-handed and where the availability of information and moral hazard should have ensured growth with stability. I suggest to you, and I suspect we might debate this in the discussion, that this crisis has shown that this is not so. Alan Greenspan to a House committee in October 2008, those of us who have looked to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity, myself included, are in a state of shocked disbelief. So where does this leave us? Back to Chairman Bernanke. We need stronger supervisory and regulatory systems under which gaps and unnecessary duplication and coverage are eliminated. Lines of supervisory authority and responsibility are clarified, and oversight powers are adequate to curb excessive leverage and risk-taking. Final quotation, and I'll stop. Martin Wolf of the Financial Times. As Minsky made clear, no permanent answer exists, but recognition of the systemic frailty of a complex financial system would be a good start.
Thanks. Many thanks. Mark Johnson provided a slightly longer paper, but that'll be published. Now we come to Dr. Timo Hinkle. Thank you very much. Let's talk into the microphone.
Sure. Thank you, Gerard. Dear distinguished guests and fellow speakers, it's going to sound like someone pushed the rewind button, and you're going to hear this previous speech again. There's a lot that I have to say that's going to be very similar to what was just said. When I gave a similar presentation about the crisis last year, the host introduced me and the topic by accounting a brief episode in his childhood when communication was still a little bit more primitive than what it is now. He received a telegram from his father, I believe, who was far away. That was very short and succinct. It said, "Start worrying. Details follow." Well, it was right to worry, and details are coming in. So I will try to give you my view of the crisis as it's unfolding. Now, the list of factors proffered as the causes of the developed world's severest financial crisis since 1929 is long and expanding, as we have just heard. And each one of them might actually warrant a separate lecture on its own. But the truth is, the crisis is best explained or described as a perfect storm, a confluence of numerous contributing factors. Just like airplane disasters are rarely attributable to a single cause, you usually hear airplane crash investigators refer to a chain of catastrophic events. And so it is really with the current mess that we find ourselves in. So let me briefly go through some of the microeconomic failures and then the macroeconomic failures. There are basically 9 macroeconomic failures that I would isolate. First, many of which we've heard before already. First, a sloppy oversight by prudential regulators and supervisors. The authorities tolerated the existence of a rapidly growing shadow banking system comprised of structured investment vehicles, conduits, and so on, which were shielded from regulatory controls. Core banks, that is those institutions that are subject to bank regulation, took advantage of this regulatory vacuum going off balance sheet. But of course, off balance sheet items were ultimately always on balance sheet items. This was really a smokescreen. Second, overly complex and misinformed securitization. The bank loans, which were formerly non-marketable, were lumped together, tranched, sliced, and diced, and sold on as mortgage-backed securities. And these asset-backed securities then were often sliced and diced again and so on for a further round of securitization. And this process of originating and distributing, heightened by a vibrant derivatives market, reduced incentives for banks to screen their customers and created a confusing menu of financial instruments whose risks were simply not fully appreciated. Third, flattering risk ratings by misguided and fundamentally conflicted rating agencies. Many fingers have been pointed at the credit rating agencies, and in my opinion, deservedly so. They bought into the Panglossian paradigm, lacking imagination when profiling risks. They are hampered by conflicts of interests. They act as raters, advisors, underwriters, and sponsors. In the words of U.S. Senator Robert Menendez, credit rating agencies are playing both coach and referee. Their decisions move markets, and their power has not been harnessed to the benefit of society. Fourth, the pro-cyclical nature of internationally imposed capital adequacy requirements and the marking to market of illiquid assets. In a downturn where fair values are neither reliable nor verifiable, asset prices quickly lose value, forcing financial institutions to shed them in order to meet capital adequacy requirements, which in turn lowers the assets' values, and so on. And this vicious cycle is then exacerbated by some quirky details contained in the Basel I and II banking regulations. Fifth, insufficient liquidity requirements. Banking regulation, by focusing on capital regulation, neglected the importance of liquidity. Once again, regulators lacked imagination in failing to anticipate the possibility that markets for entire asset classes may collapse. In bad times, cash is king. He is too readily disposed of in good times. Sixth, inappropriate accounting standards. Imperfect auditing and accounting rules strengthen the incentive to push items off balance sheet and to underinsure against various risks associated with financial institutions' portfolios. Seventh, skewed reward structures for investment managers that encouraged excessive risk-taking. Inadequate corporate governance, myopic and asymmetric reward structures in many financial institutions, performance benchmarking, and a revealing disrespect for risk management led to excessive risk-taking. Incentives for individual market participants typically were not aligned with the greater good. Eighth, narrowing profit margins due to greater international competition. Greater competition is mostly desirable, subject to an appropriate regulatory environment. Financial markets, we must remember, are characterized by strong informational asymmetries and deficiencies that make them different from standard goods markets. Letting the market rip without adequate institutional safeguards leads to instability. And finally, misguided government policy, such as the National Mortgage Associations and the Community Reinvestment Act in the U.S., financial markets are the most heavily regulated markets in the world. Government-sponsored enterprises such as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac distorted the market through their sheer size as well as their excessive risk-taking, joisted by an implicit government guarantee. A strengthening of the Community Reinvestment Act in the 1990s encouraged a loosening of lending standards that fueled the subprime mortgage sector. All these led to an excessive supply of credit, often to unbankable customers. Now, many of these causes are specific to the U.S. After all, it was the subprime mortgage sector in that country that lit the fuse. And many of the above failures were the side effects of otherwise well-intended policies. For example, the Community Reinvestment Act was drafted to reduce discriminatory credit practices against low-income neighborhoods, so-called redlining, in an attempt to reduce inequality and poverty. And these examples highlight, for me, two key lessons. And they are obvious, but they should nonetheless feature on a post-it note attached to every desk in every government department. First, well-intended policies often have unanticipated adverse effects, or side effects. And second, different policies interact with each other in wondrous, surprising, and unfortunately sometimes devastating ways. Now, among the macroeconomic failures, I will simply discuss three very briefly. We've heard more about that in the previous discussion. First, the underinvestment in many emerging market countries, especially in Asia and the oil-producing countries, leading to a global savings glut, as we've heard. After the 1997-98 East Asian crisis, regional investment never recovered to pre-crisis levels. Add to that the integration of a number of high savings countries, notably China, and the rapid wealth accumulation in commodity exporting countries, and you have the savings glut economists started worrying about already several years ago. As a consequence, long-run global interest rates have been exceptionally low. Second, overly loose monetary policy by the Federal Reserve and other central banks following the collapse of the 2000 dot-com bubble. The Federal Reserve and other key central banks were quick to lower policy rates in the wake of the bursting dot-com bubble, but slow to raise rates once the storm clouds had passed. In days gone by, central banks would have observed excessive credit growth feed into inflation of the consumer price index and responded accordingly. However, successful inflation targeting firmly anchored the public's inflation expectations so that the CPI remained close to its target. This was interpreted as confirmation that the interest rate, the policy rate, was at its correct level. But it was not. Now, how to deal with asset price bubbles is one of the major challenges remaining for central banks. And third, 15 years and more of uninterrupted economic expansion in most developed economies instilled complacency and excessive optimism in investors. Investors and the public have limited memory. Good times breed complacency and dull the imagination. Risk profiles based on recent average as opposed to long-run averages are distorted. Events in the tails of the distributions, the so-called black swans, are overlooked. Over time, risk premia fall. There's an intense search for yield. Asset prices appear to know only one direction, and that is up. References to new paradigms, whether technological or policy, are as common as they are wrong. So this long lineup of culprits suggests that this financial crisis is special. Is it really? Are there some deeper underlying origins of the crisis? Recent research on financial crises spanning the past 150 years suggests a commonality among them. Financial crises are the tail end of ever-present boom-bust cycles in the markets for equities, commodities, currencies, and other assets. These cycles are financed by credit, and there is an intimate, if unstable, relationship between credit-fueled boom-bust cycles and the business cycle. Now, the problem is that these stylized facts do not sit well with the neoclassical paradigm of economics. Financial markets are supposed to be efficient, self-correcting, and intrinsically stable. But believing in the infallibility of financial markets in 2009 stretches one's faith a little. Of course, several economists have criticized this notion, and it is therefore not surprising that theories of Keynes and Hyman Minsky, as mentioned earlier, and others are being rediscovered by those seeking answers to current events. Now, Minsky was particularly prescient, seeking to replace the efficient markets hypothesis with the so-called financial instability hypothesis, the idea that modern financial systems are intrinsically prone to bouts of speculation which often end in crises. And why is this? How is this inherent instability generated? The underlying premise of the financial instability hypothesis is the refutation of the efficient market hypothesis. Empirically, the efficient market hypothesis is extremely difficult to sustain, but economists are loath to abandon it. Its intuitiveness and formal rigor are simply too beguiling. The efficient market hypothesis derives its legitimacy by appealing to the most fundamental proposition in economics. Every market has a downward sloping demand curve and an upward sloping supply curve, whose intersection determines a market clearing price. However, credit markets are unlike goods markets. Informational asymmetries may be so severe that basic Econ 101 principles no longer apply. In credit markets, demand curves may be upward sloping as greater credit fuels asset price inflation, which, along with collateralization and marking to market, triggers higher demand for credit. And because financial markets exhibit these positive feedback effects, a fractional reserve banking system necessarily leads to self-reinforcing asset debt cycles. Government intervention, monetary policy in particular, has rarely been helpful in this regard. Central banks are often endowed with multiple objectives, which may at times conflict, to keep inflation in check and to act as lender of last resort if need be. So the debate rages on, but a growing number of economists are drawn to at least some aspects of Minsky's theories. And the million-dollar question is, what are the policy lessons we can draw from this, in particular for central banks being at the head of the financial system? Does the pendulum need to swing away from laissez-faire and back towards more regulation and government intervention? Just a couple more minutes and then I'll conclude. Let me give you three broad, very broad, but important lessons. There's not enough time for details, unfortunately. Policymakers firstly need to adopt the correct model of the financial system. In my view, it will be some rendition of the Minsky and financial instability hypothesis, though considerably more research is necessary to arrive at a coherent, rigorous, practical model. Investors will then have a better appreciation of extant risks, and policymakers can formulate more appropriate policies. Second, central banks must adapt better to their conflicted roles as demand manager and as guardian of macro-financial stability. In practice, they must consider credit and asset prices in addition to consumer prices. As an aside, the two major textbooks on monetary theory and policy, published in 2003 in the US, each no less than 600 pages long, which I confess I have used in my courses as well, do not mention financial stability once. Third, prudential regulation needs a serious overhaul. It needs to change from being pro-cyclical to becoming counter-cyclical. Policies between central banks and prudential authorities need to be better coordinated. Now, the final destination is not a land of milk and honey where boom-bust cycles are mythical concepts, but one where modest cycles are accepted as an intrinsic feature of our economies. Now, as with any policy, the devil is in the detail. We are not yet in a position to define a new best practice for managing financial systems. And I'd argue that all the pundits who claim to be in possession of the philosopher's stone are going out on a limb. Much like it took three decades to arrive at something like a current best practice of inflation targeting for central banks, so it may take three decades or more of groping for a best practice of preventing and managing crises. Provided the more pressing need for reforming prudential policies is addressed, that is, making them counter-cyclical, not pro-cyclical, I'm actually pretty confident that central banks and other government departments will be able to rise to the challenge. We must only be patient and dare, unfortunately, to make mistakes along the way. Thank you.
So we'll publish the full paper when it's published, but thanks for cutting it short. John Edwards, and then we'll go to questions and discussion. Talk to the microphone, John.
Thanks. Well, we've heard two very interesting accounts, I think, of the cause of this financial crisis, and I think it reminds us, I guess, that all financial crises are the same, and at the same time they're all different. They all almost always involve excessive risk, or what later appears to be excessive risks. They almost involve almost always involve debt, although that's not all of them involve debt, but most of them do. Most of them involve leverage of debt in their initiation. And in their development, they also share very common characteristics. They almost always are propagated, transmitted through the unwinding of leverage, through asset price deflations. As this crisis has been and is being now, and then they always have their real economic effect through loss of wealth, through bankruptcies, and loss of confidence. But all of them have different characteristics. They all originate in a slightly different way. And rather than taking a broad view, what I'd like to do is focus on just two very specific things about this crisis, which I think explain its peculiarity. And I take this view because I am myself a little reluctant to accept the broad sort of propositions that Mark, for example, put to you in what I thought was a very stimulating opening paper. That is, part of Mark's story is that the origin of this crisis lies with global current account imbalances. Essentially, part of the reason we've got this crisis is because China was running current account surpluses. and the US were running a deficit, and that China invested its reserves in US government bonds. Well, it's certainly true that the US current account deficit was increasing through this decade, and it's certainly true that the Chinese surplus was increasing through this decade. But what I ask you to contemplate is, what kind of counterfactual do we have in mind? What alternative world do we have in mind where which would be preferable? And I imagine people are not saying that we want a world where global GDP was lower than it was. So let's assume a world where global GDP was the same, but it was just had different components. That is, that China consumed more and saved less, and that correspondingly the US saved more. That China can consume more and save less, and that the US saved more and consumed less over that period. So that we didn't have an imbalance between the two countries. Now, I think you have to ask yourself, as a matter of kind of simple economics, would there be any reason to expect, in that kind of circumstances, interest rates to be lower in the US than they were, or higher? You could go either way. I mean, there's certainly a case for saying that actually they would be lower in the US under those circumstances. And I think it's also worth reflecting that today we have exactly, almost exactly, these kind of imbalances between China and the US, between OPEC and the US, East Asia and the US, and yet the problem of global liquidity has vanished. So it's not a strict function of these imbalances. It seems to me you've got to look elsewhere for an explanation of the peculiarity of this experience. I'd say the same thing for some of the other very broad explanations of what was happening. For example, it's often said, and I think both Timo and Mark mentioned this in the course of their talks, that one of the causes of this was that Alan Greenspan lowered the cash rate to 1% in 1993 and kept it there till 1994. Now, I think Greenspan's got a lot to answer for in this episode, but I'm not sure that this is it. I do think we need to bear in mind that at every FOMC from the middle of 1974, for I think the following 16 meetings, the cash rate was increased at every subsequent meeting. We need to bear in mind, I think, that the 10-year government bond rate was increasing from 2004 to 2007. And it's true that credit spreads, that is, the cost of risk, let's say, was narrowing through that period. But that could hardly be due to the Federal Reserve. Could hardly be due to the policy of the Federal Reserve, and may, in fact, have been the outcome of the kind of financial innovation which bears part of the responsibility for the crisis we're now in. I think the same is true of some of the other explanations. For example, the US federal deficit is blamed for some of the issues in the US, although, in fact, the US federal deficit was coming down every year from 2004 to 2007. US home price inflation is blamed, and I'm sure it bears some responsibility, and there's no doubt that US home prices were in some measures too high. But it's also true that home prices rose much faster here in the decade to 2007, and also in the UK, in Spain, in Ireland, New Zealand, Canada and Denmark all rose much faster than they did in the US. The most common theme you find in explaining the crisis is just the increase in debt to GDP. Mark mentioned this, and its location in the household sector and the finance sector. But again, this has been with us for a very long time. It's been increasing for a very long time, for at least the last 15 years in the US. So it behoves us to ask why it was a particular issue in 2007, if it was a particular issue. You know, what was the mechanism that followed from one thing to the other? I do think there's a risk in listing all the culprits, as Timo did and as Mark did, that what we end up doing actually is listing most of the reasons that the 90s and the early years of this decade were, in terms of global prosperity, so successful. We also leave out, I think, a kind of, in a weird sense, an Australian perspective on this, where we do have, I think, we're entitled to have here a unique kind of perspective on this issue, and I'll tell you why, because we might complain about the high current account deficit in the US, but it's actually been higher here for most of that period. We might complain about higher US international liabilities, but ours are much higher, much higher, four times as high as the share of GDP as they are in the US. I mentioned our house prices compared to medium income are higher than the US. Our household savings, much the same, just as low. In some respects, a bit lower. But we didn't have the kind of financial crisis that the US did. We're certainly feeling some of the ill effects of a global downturn, but we ourselves didn't experience a crisis like the US did, although we had all these similar characteristics. So it just seems to me there must be something else going on there that we need to look at. And what I particularly think is one kind of, it would be highfalutin to call it an analytic approach, but one way of thinking about it is to just concentrate on what we regard as essential to explain this circumstance. What's the essential part of the story in the narrative of this episode? And we begin, I think, with... we have to begin, I think, with the US, and I think we have to begin with the US subprime market, the subprime mortgage market. And in a way, the a notion of how that market worked and what the consequences of it were is enough to take us a long way into explaining this episode. Subprime borrowers in the US are people who, by definition, have experienced difficulties in paying their loans in the past. Now, Timo mentioned that the Community Reinvestment Act in the US may have encouraged subprime lending, but so far as I know, there was nothing in that legislation whatsoever which encouraged banks, which rewarded banks in any way for lending money to people who couldn't pay it back, which is what subprime lending was. The whole trick of subprime lending rested not on the credit strength of the borrower, but on the notion that US house prices would continue to increase. And from 2004, 2005, 2006, subprime mortgages, that is, mortgages issued to people who had a poor credit history, were issued and which were generally issued with a very high loan to valuation ratio, because after all they were poor people, didn't have much money, increased to something like 50% of issuance of new mortgages over those years, and came to be 15% of the US housing market. And their characteristic was always that their repayment, their refinancing after a introductory period would depend upon house prices increasing. That was the only rationale, the only sensible rationale of those mortgages. And of course, we know, everybody knew, that house prices couldn't keep increasing indefinitely. And when they stopped increasing in 2006, almost immediately, the delinquency amongst subprime lending began to increase very, very rapidly. It aided, of course, by the other characteristic of the US market, which is that in half of the states of the union are walkaway states, that is, where either legally or in practice there is no recourse on the part of the lender to the assets of the borrower other than the house, other than the home on which the loan has been made, so that as soon as the value of it falls below the loan, the borrower has every incentive to send the keys back to the lender and leave. Well, that's what happened. I mean, it sounds incredible. It sounds so simple. Not a very sophisticated piece of financial engineering involved here. Not a complicated calculation. I mean, it's just the oldest, simplest, silliest financial era in the world. And yet it's so frequently repeated. Well, that was the start of it. It doesn't actually explain the global financial crisis. All it explains is how the US could get to, how lenders in the US, including, I must say, some foreign banks, including my own, could get to lose what ultimately looks like being around about $500 or $600 billion lending money to people in the US who weren't likely to pay it back. But $600 billion is not a lot, actually, given the gravity of this global crisis. It doesn't really explain it at all, particularly because most of that, if not more than that, has since been matched by increased capital of US banks. In other words, they have diluted their equity, matched their losses with new capital, and were that all there was to it, we would have had a very embarrassing event in the US finance industry, which would have had implications in other countries, particularly the UK and Europe, but that would have been it. But the reason it became, of course, a vastly more serious event was its link with the simultaneous development over the last 15 years of off-balance sheet vehicles held by commercial banks and huge trading positions held by US investment banks. US investment banks, very good example. So I think Mark mentioned 30 or 40 times assets, $30 or $40 of assets for each dollar of capital, the rest borrowed. So you only have to have a 3% loss in the value of an asset and your liabilities exceeded your assets. And the assets that they were holding, as it turned out, in very many cases, in the very big US investment banks, very, very substantial assets, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars, a fairly large proportion of them, these collateralised debt obligations, which included subprime loans as part of their structure of thousands of mortgages. And as I think Mark mentioned, these were primarily over-the-counter instruments, that is, they're created, they're not traded on exchanges, they're created by traders for other traders, and they're very hard to value. They're particularly hard to value if there's a very rapid change in the an unexpected change in the amount of default that and delinquency that's involved within the mortgages that are part of the structure. So on the one hand, the assets of huge assets of investment banks were losing value, and at the same time they had moved into a circumstance where over the last decade more and more they were financing themselves in overnight markets using asset-backed commercial paper repos. And again, like the subprime issue, it was very straightforward. Huge investment banks with illiquid assets, hard to value, financed overnight by people who every day have to make a decision whether they continue to finance them. And as their asset position deteriorated, their funding dried up, and one after another, they either went broke or turned themselves into commercial banks and went to the Federal Reserve for support. Well, in a way, that's it. I mean, that takes us through the through to the collapse of Lehman in mid-September, and the collapse of Lehman revealing the collapse of Lehman leaving, because it was so connected with all every other financial institution of any consequence throughout the world, with banks once again as they had in earlier phases in the crisis, but to an extraordinarily amplified degree, distrustful of each other and unwilling to lend. The commercial paper market in the US ceased to exist temporarily. Bank lending to each other ceased to exist. This is September. I mean, I may say that at the end of August, not very long ago, this looked like an issue we were getting on top of. It was the collapse of Lehman, I think, that made it all 10 times worse and has brought it to our current circumstance. Well, our current circumstance is one where we're seeing, of course, we're not seeing any further substantial financial market failures, and we can't, because the major nations met after the collapse of Lehman and decided that no systemically important financial institution would now be allowed to fail, which was, you know, a sensible decision. We now guarantee, in this country and in most countries, we guarantee effectively the borrowing of banks and major financial institutions. But we've moved on to a circumstance where this has now passed into the real economy, we have yet to see how profoundly we're changed by it. Well, that's my take on it, that briefly, that you don't need a big apparatus of everything that was happening in the global economy from 1990 through to 2007. It didn't have as its automatic endpoint where we are now. It didn't. And not only that, I think when we get out of this, the world economy is going to look roughly similar to what it looked like in 2006. That is, we're still going to have imbalances between China and the US. We're still going to have debt as a fairly high proportion. Debt to GDP ratio will still be reasonably high. What I do hope, though, in common, where I certainly agree with Mark and Timo, is on the basic lesson of this crisis. The basic lesson of this crisis, in my view, is not that it's wicked for China to run a current account surplus, or the US to have a deficit, or for Australia to have a deficit for that matter. It's not, in my view, that rising house prices are wicked, or the debt is wicked. What is wicked, what is absolutely wicked, is the negligence of US authorities in regulating their system. The irresponsible negligence of the US. This is not a world problem. There's not a global solution to this. It doesn't need a G20 agreement. What it needs is the US Congress and the US administration to properly regulate their markets. It is ridiculous, as Mark said, that we have a variety of regulators, the SEC, the Commodities Futures Trading Corporation, the Fed, the Office of the Comptroller General of the Currency, and two or three other regulators all claiming authority for different aspects of the US financial system, and none of them exercising it. None of them exercising it. When the credit default swap market, when it was discovered how poorly controlled the current the US credit default swap market is, and Congress decided something had to do about it, three agencies claimed responsibility for controlling it, but none of them were. But three of them claimed responsibility for doing so. The big difference, in my view, between Australia and the US in respect of this crisis is not the configuration of our economies, which are very similar, other than we're, you know, minuscule compared to the US, but the quality of our regulation. And to my mind, that's exactly what the US has to attend to we'll certainly have other crises, but we don't need to have this particular one come back in this particular form. Thank you.
Thanks to our three speakers, and thanks to Mellisons for the use of this facility.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again.